This is Steve Carroll, and you're listening to the EM Basic Podcast. Today, we're going to talk about back pain. Now, before you start to groan and roll your eyes, just realize that this is a common reason for people to come to the emergency department. In the early days of EM Rap, Mel Herbert caught a ton of flack for doing a segment on back pain. One person wondered if the chief complaint of total body dolor was going to be the next topic. While the vast majority of back pain that we see isn't serious, we need to define those few people that have serious pathology. Today, we'll go over how to take a really good history on patients with back pain because it will guide the rest of our testing. We'll also go over how to do a thorough physical exam, how to form a good back pain differential, how to selectively use labs and imaging, and how to get your patients feeling better. As always, this podcast doesn't represent the views or opinions of the Department of Defense, the U.S. Army, or the Shawshank EM Residency Program. So let's get started. As always, make sure to read the chart and the triage note. Triage nurses are pretty good about asking about certain red flags like incontinence or leg weakness, so the vast majority of triage notes will have mention of the lack of these signs. Pay attention to the vital signs. Pay particular attention to the blood pressure and pulse, as well as the patient's temperature. If any of these are way out of whack, then you need to be extra concerned. Now let's talk about how to take a good history on a patient with back pain. One of the most important things to ask is what the patient was doing when their back pain started. A 20-year-old that just lifted a heavy box is a much different patient from an elderly male with hypertension whose back pain started while he was at rest. You also ask your standard OPQRST questions about their pain. Ask them where it hurts and have them point it out. Is it on one side of their back or both sides? What does the pain feel like? Also ask, is it there constantly? Does it come or go? Or is it colicky in nature? Finally, ask if they're having any urinary symptoms or blood in their urine. The most important question to ask are the ones that cover the red flags. We'll talk about specific diagnoses in a minute. First, ask the patient about when the pain is worse. Is the pain worse at night, or does it get worse during the day when they exert themselves? Pain that wakes the patient up at night is much more worrisome than pain that gets worse throughout the day. Also, ask the patient about any leg weakness, any numbness or tingling in the groin or saddle area, or any changes in their bowel or bladder. What I'd like to ask is, are you having any incontinence or feeling like you want to urinate but can't? Another red flag for back pain is perirectal or saddle numbness. What I usually like to ask is to say, I know this sounds like a weird question, but does it feel any different when you wipe yourself after going to the bathroom? You also want to ask about any fevers, night sweats, or unintended weight loss. Also ask the patient about any IV drug use. Finally, make sure to get a complete medical history. Pay particular attention to any history of hypertension, diabetes, or a known abdominal aortic aneurysm. Back pain in a patient with a history of cancer needs a very thorough workup. Finally, make sure to get a surgical history and try to correlate it with any of the patient's symptoms. Next, let's move on to a focus exam of the back. As always, it's important to do a complete exam, so don't neglect the HENT exam and the heart and the lung exam. Next, ask the patient to point where it hurts. Clarify whether it's right in the middle or in the paraspinal area. Check to each side for CVA tenderness. Palpate where the patient hurts and see if that increases the patient's pain. Next, be sure to do an abdominal exam. Back pain plus abdominal pain is a different differential than just back pain alone. In males, be sure to check a testicular exam. In both males and females, I usually do a quick sensory exam of the groin and saddle area. I usually drag a finger across their suprapubic area and their inguinal crease and ask them if it feels normal. Technically, to be complete, you should do a rectal exam on your patients with a back pain. However, I think it's slightly excessive to say that every person with back pain needs a rectal exam. If you're a 20-year-old who just lifted a heavy box with no red flags, then I don't think you need one. However, if you're an older person with a focal lower extremity deficit, then they should get a rectal exam. One of the things you're testing for is the perianal sensation. You want to check the sensation around the rectum. After that, you'll test for rectal tone. A decreased rectal tone is a worrisome finding, and it needs to be investigated further. Finally, check a good motor and sensory exam of the lower extremities. Check the patient's hip flexor strength by putting your hand above the patient's knee and having them lift up. Next, check a sensory exam on both sides. Take your fingers and run them across the outside of the thighs, the inside of the thighs, the outside of their calves, the inside of their calves, on the outside and inside of the feet, and on the bottoms of the feet. Finally, check a straight leg raise test. With the patient lying flat on their back, take one leg and with it straight, raise it up to between 30 and 70 degrees. If that gives the patient pain in the sciatic distribution from their buttocks to their knees, then it's positive and suggests a herniated disc. Let's go over the history and physical one more time. You want to address any vital sign abnormalities, get a thorough history of when the pain started and what it feels like, and ask the patient what they were doing. Make sure to address the red flags like fever, night sweats, pain that is worse at night, unintended weight loss, or IV drug use. Also ask about leg weakness, numbness or tingling in the groin area, urinary retention or incontinence, or if it feels weird when they wipe themselves. For the exam, check the back area and find out exactly where they hurt. Don't neglect the rest of the exam, and make sure to check an abdominal exam and testicular exam in males. Check a thorough motor and sensory exam of the lower extremities. You want to make sure to check all flexor and extensor strength of the thigh, lower leg, and ankle. Check the sensation on both sides of the legs. And finally, check the sensation in the groin and inner thigh area, or the saddle area. If the patient has red flags and you're concerned about their back pain, you should do a rectal exam. Make sure to check for numbness in the perirectal area and for rectal tone. Decreased sensation or tone is a very worrisome sign for a serious cause of back pain. Now let's talk about the differential diagnosis of back pain. Like I said before, most of the back pain that we see is benign, and we can get patients through the ED with some pain medications and not much testing. However, there are many serious causes of back pain, and we need to make sure that we don't miss any of them. Here's my philosophy on back pain. Start with the assumption that the patient has a serious cause of their back pain. From there, take a thorough history, do a good exam, and check for the red flags. If the patient has a non-concerning history and exam and has no red flags, try to talk yourself into a serious cause. If you can't talk yourself into anything serious, then you can end your workup with little or no testing as long as you are convinced that this isn't serious. If you start from the assumption that this is a bad cause of back pain and work backwards from there, you won't miss the badness. So let's talk about the differential diagnosis of back pain. I'll list each diagnosis first, and then I'll go back through each one of them and talk a little bit about each one. Abdominal aortic aneurysm, aortic dissection, renal colic or urolithiasis, cauda equina syndrome, epidural abscess, tumor or mass, fracture, pyelonephritis or UTI, abdominal pathology, zoster, and finally musculoskeletal sprain and strain. So let's go back through each one of these diagnoses one at a time. First of all, abdominal aortic aneurysm, or AAA. So you're going to think of this in an older patient with hypertension and new onset back pain. Have a very low threshold to put an ultrasound on their abdomen and make sure that they don't have a AAA. Don't be fooled by a little bit of blood in the urine and think that a 70-year-old has a new onset kidney stone. That diagnosis just doesn't make sense. A symptomatic AAA over 5 centimeters needs the OR immediately. Any asymptomatic AAA between 2 and 5 centimeters needs close referral for follow-up. Next is aortic dissection. So this usually presents with chest pain, but it can also present with back pain. Consider it in a patient that has both chest and back pain, or in a patient whose pain has a ripping or tearing quality to it. Also consider it in a patient with back pain who has pulse or motor deficits. Aortic dissections are treated with aggressive blood pressure control with IV medications. A dissection of the aortic arch is also managed with an immediate trip to the OR for a repair. Next is renal colic or urolithiasis. So this is typically a diagnosis of younger patients, but it can be seen in the older ages as well. This is usually a sudden onset of unilateral back and flank pain with CVA tenderness. Microscopic hematuria is present in about 70-80% of patients. These patients look like they can't get comfortable. They will writhe around on the stretcher in a very characteristic way. This is opposed to a person with appendicitis or serious abdominal pathology that tends to want to stay as still as possible to avoid moving. Next is cauda equina syndrome. This syndrome is why we ask all the questions about bowel or bladder retention or incontinence. Classically, this is a patient with a sudden onset of ripping or tearing back pain that has a loss of bowel or bladder function or sensory or motor loss. Now, the board's answer is to say that the patient has saddle anesthesia with bowel or bladder incontinence. However, in the earlier stages, patients actually have urinary retention followed by an overflow incontinence. Cauda equina is caused by a disc that acutely herniates into the spinal cord. A disc that has slowly herniated into the spinal cord should only cause pain or numbness or tingling. Those are treated conservatively at first, followed by elective surgery if they progress to motor deficits. However, if your patient has a sudden loss of motor function or bladder incontinence, this is called Aquinas syndrome, and this is a surgical emergency. They need to get to the OR with all the urgency of a ruptured AAA. We'll talk more about the workup of cauda equina in the workup section. Epidural abscess. So a classic patient for this is an IV drug user with fever and back pain. However, diabetics and those who have had recent epidural injections or back surgery are also at risk. If a patient has fever and back pain with concerning history, you need to consider this diagnosis. Once again, we'll talk more about this diagnosis in the workup section. Next is tumor or mass. So a tumor or mass that is causing back pain is usually diagnosed in two kinds of patients. Those patients that have worrisome red flags like weight loss, back pain at night, or a history of cancer. The other patient population that is at risk are those patients with a current history of active cancer, especially those with known metastatic cancer. If your patient has motor deficits, then they should get an emergent MRI. They should also get an emergent MRI if they have a known history of cancer, because they may need emergent radiation therapy to reduce the size of the mass so they don't lose function in their lower extremities. Next is fracture. Obviously, you're going to think of this in a patient who has a history of direct trauma to the back, but in the older population, you have to be concerned for pathologic fractures caused by metastasis. If the patient truly points to the middle of their back instead of their paraspinal muscles, you should be more concerned for a fracture than just a muscle sprain or strain. Pyelonephritis. Think of this in a patient with back pain and fever, with or without urinary symptoms. I've seen several cases of pyelo present without frank lower urinary symptoms, especially in the elderly population. So I have a low threshold to check urine in any patient with back pain, especially if you don't have a better explanation for the pain. Next is abdominal pathology. So a lot of our patients don't read the textbooks that we read. A while back, our ED had a child who came in with pure back pain with no good explanation for it. I believe the child was about 9 or 10 years old. He had no fever, no vomiting, he was PO tolerant, just this persistent back pain. You know what the final diagnosis was? Appendicitis. This kid had a retroperitoneal appendix. So the sooner you realize that this job isn't fair, the better off you'll be, because in the ED, we are the kings and queens of the atypical presentation. So make sure to cast your net wide and consider other causes to the patient's back pain outside of the actual back area. Next is zoster. So if you have an older patient with back pain in a very specific distribution, then this could be zoster. What happens is that the zoster virus that causes chickenpox lays dormant in the posterior horn of your spinal cord. Under times of stress, it can reactivate and erupt as a painful rash. However, the rash itself can be preceded by several days of intense pain that just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I learned this lesson well as a medical student with an older woman who I thought had a stone, but the senior resident rightly picked up on the very precise distribution of her pain. After a few tests, we ruled out the badness and we started on acyclovir. Finally, musculoskeletal sprain and strain. So think of this as a diagnosis of exclusion. After you exhausted all the previous diagnoses and think that they aren't very likely, then this is what most patients will be diagnosed with when they come into the ER with their back pain. So let's go through each diagnosis rapid fire and the key buzzwords for each. Abdominal aortic aneurysm. Think of this in an older patient with hypertension and new onset back pain. Have a very low threshold to put an ultrasound on their abdomen if your patient is older. Aortic dissection usually presents with chest pain, but it can also present with back pain. Consider this in a patient who has both chest and back pain, or in a patient whose pain has a ripping or tearing quality to it. Also consider it in a patient with back pain who has pulse or motor deficits. Renal colic or urolithiasis. Usually this is a sudden onset of unilateral back and flank pain with CVA tenors. Microscopic hematuria is present in about 70 to 80% of patients, and they usually look very uncomfortable. Cauda equina syndrome. This is a patient with sudden onset of ripping or tearing back pain that is a change in their bowel or bladder function or sensory or motor loss. Epidural abscess. The classic patient for this is an IV drug user with fever and back pain, or diabetics, or those who have had recent epidural injections or back surgery. Tumor or mass. These are usually older patients who have worrisome red flags like weight loss, back pain at night, or a history of active or remote cancer. Also consider this in a patient with a history of active cancer, especially if it is metastatic. Fracture. So this is a patient with trauma, or a patient with a history of cancer or suspected cancer. Pyelonephritis. Think of this in a patient with back pain and a fever, with or without urinary symptoms. abdominal pathology. This is just a reminder not to neglect the belly. Zoster, so this is usually an older patient with back pain and a very specific distribution, pretty much like a dermatome. Musculoskeletal sprain and strain, so this is a diagnosis of exclusion after you've exhausted all the other previous diagnoses. So how can you remember all of the bad causes for back pain? I love mnemonics, so I'll share this one taught to me as an intern by one of our senior residents. The mnemonic CRAFTY will help you remember all the bad causes of back pain. That's C-R-A-F-T-I. It stands for C is for caudoequina, R is for renal, A is for aortic aneurysm or aortic dissection, F is for fracture, T is for tumor, and I is for infection such as pyelonephritis or an epidural abscess. So one more time, that's CRAFTY, C-R-A-F-T-I. C is for caudoequina, R is for renal, A is for aortic aneurysm or aortic dissection, F is for fracture, T is for tumor, and I is for infection like pyelonephritis or an epidural abscess. Now let's talk about how to work up all these causes of back pain. The first pearl is to consider doing a urine in just about every patient. You can let the clinical picture be your guide. Obviously, a patient with urinary symptoms, fever, and back pain will get a urine. Once again, if you're a young, healthy person who just lifted a heavy box and your paraspinals hurt, I don't think they universally need a UA unless they're female and are going to get imaging. That being said, have a low threshold to get a urine sample in these patients. What about other labs? If you're considering other serious diagnoses, you need to let the clinical picture be your guide. If you're thinking of ruptured AAA, get all your usual labs and type and cross them for 8 units off the bat, and while you're at it, call for emergency release blood to the patient's bedside. If you're thinking of an epidural abscess, ESR and CRP can be helpful in the right situation, although they can be elevated if the patient recently had surgery. If you're worried about metastasis in an older patient, then a CBC and a Chem-10 isn't unreasonable. There really isn't any magic bullet here for labs. Use your judgment instead of just shotgunning all your labs. So what about imaging? This also depends on what you're looking for. If you're looking for a AAA, your first test should be a bedside ultrasound. If it's over 5 centimeters and they are symptomatic, you are done. Get the surgeon on the phone and the patient ready for the OR. If you're thinking of an aortic dissection, get a CT scan of the aorta with contrast. If you're thinking of a kidney stone, then a CT scan without contrast is the best imaging to get. What about the indications for plain films and new-onset non-traumatic back pain? The American College of Physicians and the American College of Radiology have recommendations for plain films and back pain. Here are the American College of Radiology guidelines with one caveat. So these guidelines are recent significant trauma or mild trauma older than age 50, unexplained weight loss, unexplained fever, immunosuppression, a history of cancer, IV drug use, osteoporosis, prolonged use of glucocorticoids, age greater than 70, a focal neurological deficit, progressive or disabling symptoms, and a duration greater than 6 weeks. So you'll notice that the ACR says age greater than 70. I like the ACP guidelines because they say age above 50, because that is more conservative, and it's around the age where we diagnose a lot more malignancies. When you think about these red flags in context of the differential diagnosis, you can reason through most of them or look them up during a shift if you need to. Now let's talk about when you need an emergent MRI from the ED. If you're considering the diagnosis of caudoequina, epidural abscess, or a tumor causing impingement on the spinal cord, then you need an MRI immediately. These diagnoses are very time sensitive and they need emergent intervention. Now that's not to say that everyone with a little back pain needs a stat MRI. However, if you have hard motor findings or worrisome urinary or bowel symptoms, then you need a stat MRI. You need to call the radiologist and tell them exactly what you are worried about and that you need it done immediately. Let me also talk about another imaging test for caudoequina, this time using the bedside ultrasound. If you're concerned about caudoequina, you can check a post-void residual to see if the patient is having a urinary retention. Classically, this is done by asking the patient to urinate, then putting a straight catheter or a Foley catheter in and seeing how much drains from the bladder after they've had a chance to urinate. Anything over 100 cc's is abnormal. However, you can do a post-void residual on an ultrasound machine as well without having to put a catheter in. Have the patient urinate on their own and then immediately come to their bedside with an ultrasound machine or a bladder scanner. I'll go over how to do this on a sonocyte because it's what I've learned on And as always, I don't take money from Sonosite or anyone else. If you're using a Sonosite, select the abdomen calculations and look for volume with three measurements. Freeze an image of the patient's bladder in the horizontal plane, with the probe indicator pointing to the patient's right side. Click on the V1 button and measure the largest horizontal distance of the bladder, and then hit the Save Calc button. Next, measure the largest vertical distance, press the V2 button, and then press Save Calc again. Finally, you have to get the depth measurement, so flip the probe with the indicator pointing towards the patient's head and measure the depth of the bladder. Freeze an image and measure the largest distance you can find, plug it into V3 button, and it will calculate a volume based on a mathematical equation. You now have the exact same post-void residual that you would have gotten by putting a catheter in. One more time on the workup, have a low threshold for a UA, CBC and chem panel as needed, but let the clinical situation be your guide. An elevated ESR and CRP can help you if you suspect an epidural abscess. Get a bedside ultrasound if you're suspecting a AAA. Get a CT aorta with contrast if you suspect an aortic dissection, and a CT of the abdomen and pelvis without contrast if you're suspecting a kidney stone. Plain films are useful if you have any of the red flags, such as age over 50, a history of cancer, immunocompromise, or IV drug use, among a few other red flags. If you're suspecting cauda equina or cord compression from a tumor, get an MRI stat from the ED. A bedside test for cauda equina is a post-void residual. Have the patient urinate on their own, then either insert a Foley catheter or use an ultrasound to see how much urine is left in the bladder. Anything over 100 cc's is abnormal and needs to be investigated further. Now let's talk about how to effectively treat back pain. At this point, you've taken a good history, done a complete exam, and the patient has no red flags. So you're thinking this is musculoskeletal back pain. What's the best way to treat the pain? Unfortunately, there aren't any clear answers, and there are many ways to treat back pain, and everyone has their own theories and so-called cocktails. I'll go over a few of them here. NSAIDs are often the first-line treatment for back pain. In the DED, we often reach for Toradol. Toradol is an injectable NSAID that is basically IV or IM Motrin. The reality is that when Toradol has been compared to oral Motrin, there isn't any difference in pain control. Some will argue that the only indication for Toradol is a patient with a kidney stone who isn't PO tolerant. My non-evidence-based take on this is that when you give Toradol IV or IM, patients think you're doing something for them that they can't do at home. This may seem a little dishonest, but the reality is that you need to find a way to get your patients with musculoskeletal back pain feeling better quickly so they can go home. If Toradol gets that done, then that's great. So the dose for Toradol is 30 milligrams IV or 60 milligrams IM. I would be cautious in patients over about 60 years of age or so and those with renal failure. If they have an elevated creatinine, you probably should not be giving them Toradol. If Toradol works well, then patients can go home on Motrin over the counter. I usually advise 400 milligrams PO 3 times a day with food. Studies have shown that you don't get any more pain relief with anything more than 400 milligrams. The only thing you get more of with 800 milligrams is more side effects. The next class of drugs to talk about is opiates. If your patient is having a ton of pain in the ED, you can give them IV morphine, but most people do just fine with oral opioids like Vicodin or Percocet. Just make sure to ask the patient if they have a ride available before you give them narcotics. A lot of patients with back pain drive themselves in, and you want to make sure that they have a ride before you give them anything sedating. If your patient feels better after oral narcotics, then you can send them home with a limited amount. I don't prescribe any more than 15 Vicodin or Percocet at a time out of the ED. If the patient needs more than that, then they need to be coming back to the ED and or following up with their primary care doctor. Another class of drugs you can use are muscle relaxers such as Flexeril and Scalaxin. The term muscle relaxer is kind of a misnomer. These drugs really don't relax muscles as much as they provide analgesia and sedation. I use Flexeril most often. The dose is 5 to 10 milligrams PO 3 times a day. You could also use benzodiazepines in addition to NSAIDs and even opiates. They don't directly relax spasming muscles, but they do help the patient relax and get rest. Valium 5 milligrams PO usually works pretty well. I will often send patients home with 5 tablets of Valium and tell them to take it at night to help them sleep. I make it clear to the patient in their discharge instructions to not take Valium within 4 hours of either Vicodin or Percocet to avoid oversedation. While we're talking about oversedation, let's talk about good discharge instructions for back pain. If you're prescribing medications that will cause sedation, you need to warn patients about this. Tell them not to drive or use alcohol while taking these medications. Also stress the importance of not combining opiates and benzodiazepines within a couple hours of each other. In the discharge instructions, you should spell out these warnings by saying no alcohol or driving while using Vicodin or Valium. You can also document in your chart that you gave sedation warnings, and this should cover you if anything comes up. Finally, when you're discharging patients with back pain, always tell them what to come back for. Usually this will be spelled out if your institution gives out pre-printed discharge instructions, but I like to tell patients these myself because I think they remember it better. I tell patients to come back if they have increased pain, new numbness and tingling, or weakness in their legs, or any changes in their bowel or bladder. So real quick, let's go over the medications one more time. First line treatment is often NSAIDs. Toradol, either 30 milligrams IV or 60 milligrams IM is a good choice. Use caution in patients over, I would say, about age 60 or those with any kidney problems or an elevated creatinine. Also, opiates are also a good choice for back pain as well. You can send a patient home with a limited amount of Vicodin or Percocet, probably no more than about 15 tablets each. Another drug class is muscle relaxers like Flexeril and Scalaxin. They pretty much just help you sleep. The dose for Flexeril is 5 to 10 milligrams PO three times a day. Benzodiazepines such as Valium are also helpful for back pain. I usually give patients 5 milligrams and I give them 5 tablets and tell them to take it at night to help them sleep. Just make sure to discharge your patients with good instructions. Tell them what to come back for, such as increased pain, new numbness or tingling, or weakness in their legs, or any changes in their bowel or bladder. And make sure you give them precautions about the sedating properties of the medicines that you're going to prescribe them. So that's all I have for now. Thanks for listening and keep the emails and comments coming. There will be some changes for EM Basic coming down the road, so stay tuned. I'm working to get episodes out more consistently every two weeks, but as we all know, residency has a lot of various time demands, so I'm doing my best. I'm also working on show summaries for all the episodes, and I'll let you know when those are ready. Fortunately, my schedule over the next few months is a lot easier, so I'll do my best to get more EM Basic out there to everyone. That's all for now. Until next time, this is Steve Carroll for the EM Basic Podcast, signing off.